war crimes. And rallies are held in various Iranian cities and other countries to condemn Israel's atrocities in Gaza and the West's support for the regime. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. Now Palestinians are experiencing an endless spiral of death and destruction as the Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip enters its 171st day. Medical sources say that Israeli forces have committed 8 massacres in Gaza over the past 24 hours, killing 84 civilians and injuring scores of others. At least 10 people were killed in the Israeli bombing of Rafah. One Palestinian was killed in Gaza City. Israeli warplanes also hit the Al-Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza, leaving a number of Palestinians dead and injured. Meanwhile, the regime's forces have besieged 2 more hospitals apart from Al-Shifa and blocked food and medical aid into Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says Israel had informed that it would no longer allow UNRWA food convoys into northern Gaza. UNRWA has called the blockade outrageous. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has claimed more than 32,200 lives, mostly women and children. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh says Israeli forces are stepping up their attacks on the Gaza Strip, leaving behind more civilian casualties. Let's take a listen.
Let me begin with the latest statement of Gaza's health ministry in terms of the Israeli crimes committed against the Palestinian people and the number of the Palestinian casualties across all areas of Gaza Strip. As over the last 24 hours, the Israeli occupation forces committed at least 8 appalling massacres against the Palestinian residents in all areas of Gaza Strip, claiming the lives of at least 82 Palestinian civilians and injuring some 110 others. These numbers actually are still soaring with the continuous and the incessant Israeli attacks and airstrikes that are still hitting several areas of Gaza Strip. From Rafah City, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks over the Palestinian residential buildings there. From dawn hours so far, we are talking about roughly 21 Palestinian civilians have been killed over those attacks, as several residential buildings were hammered by the Israeli warplanes. These airstrikes are still continued so far, as the eastern part of the city were subjected to heavy attacks and heavy bombardments of the Israeli airstrikes. When it comes to Khan Yunis city, the Israeli occupation forces conducted a ground offensive against the Nasser Medical Complex and Al Amal Hospital, located in the western part of the city, amid heavy gunfire and continuous airstrikes and continuous shelling of the Israeli tanks reaching those areas. Needless to mention that those areas were subjected to a brutal ground offensive that targeted them over the last couple of months, as the vast majority of those buildings and those houses were completely or partially destroyed over the chronic Israeli attacks and incursions that reached that area.
Israeli forces have been raping and executing women during their raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. That's according to a Palestinian woman who was trapped in a building near the hospital, witnessing the tragedy unfolding there. Jamila Al-Hisi says Palestinian women were also starved, tortured and kidnapped. In another horrific detail, she added that the Israeli forces pulled dead bodies from under the rubble to unleash their dogs on them. Al-Hisi had been trapped in a building near Al-Shifa Hospital for 6 days before being forced out by the Israeli forces. She said troops also torched a building where Palestinian civilians were taking shelter, burning to death entire families inside. Israel launched its raid and siege on Al-Shifa Hospital a week ago, killing at least 170 people and abducting hundreds more. The hospital was Gaza's biggest medical facility before the Israeli onslaught on the besieged strip. Meanwhile, UN Chief Antonio Guterres has renewed calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying that the besieged Palestinian territory needs a flood of aid.
Looking at Gaza, it almost appears that the 4 horsemen of war, famine, conquest and death are galloping across it. And that is why the time for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire is now, And in the Ramadan spirit of compassion, I also urge the immediate and unconditional release of hostages. The suffering must end. Palestinians in Gaza desperately need what has been promised, a flood of aid.
Guterres was speaking following talks with Egypt's president and foreign minister in Cairo. The UN chief said the only effective way to ramp up aid delivery to Gaza is by road. He also called for Israel's firm commitment to allow aid to reach all parts of the besieged territory. Guterres is visiting Egypt and Jordan as part of an annual Ramadan solidarity tour to Muslim countries. On Saturday, he toured the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt. The crossing is the only access point where aid trucks can enter Gaza. But they are stuck on Egypt's side of the border as Israel continues to block aid from entering Gaza, where people are starving. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has condemned Israel's horrific and inhumane crimes at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Nasser Kanani said those atrocities have added to Israel's shameful acts and its dark list of crimes. He expressed sadness over the killing of scores of people over the past days in Israel's raid on the hospital and its restriction on basic medical supplies. He also referred to reports indicating that Palestinian women were raped and tortured during the Israeli raid on Al-Shifa. Kanani urged an international probe to expose the volume of Israel's war crimes at the medical facility. He recalled the responsibilities of the international community and Islamic states with regard to Palestinian lives in war-ridden Gaza. Al-Shifa Hospital is not the only health facility under Israeli siege. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent, Israeli forces have laid siege to two more hospitals in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are also suffering from growing Israeli violence. In the latest such acts, Israeli forces abducted over a dozen Palestinians across the West Bank, while scores of settlers raided the Al-Aqsa compound in the occupied Al-Quds. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Munah Kandil, joined us earlier with more details.
The Israeli forces storm Palestinian areas on a daily basis. This morning, the Israelis had arrested at least 15 Palestinians from across the occupied West Bank. The majority of those Palestinians were detained in Jenin and as well as Al-Khalil in the village of Al-Liban Al-Gharbi, North Ramallah. And the majority of those had been arrested by the Israeli forces were former prisoners. Even if those Palestinian prisoners and former prisoners finished their sentences and they were released several years ago, however, we have been noticing that the Israeli forces were immediately storming the houses of ex-Palestinian prisoners and arresting them, as well as family members of Palestinian prisoners who are still incarcerated in Israeli jails. As you have mentioned, The Israeli settlers, had stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex today. Over 100 Israeli settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as well as they were celebrating one of their Jewish holidays known as Purim, or in the as the Jews know them as the Sukkot feast. Of course, we are speaking about over 100 Israeli settlers protected and supported by the Israeli forces. At the same time, the Palestinian Muslims are not allowed to enter Al-Quds or Al-Aqsa. West Bank residents are completely denied access to Al-Aqsa or entering Al-Quds only on Fridays, with women above the age of 50 and men above the age of 55 and after getting Israeli issued permits.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has been engaged in fighting with the Israeli regime on Lebanon's southern border since the onset of the war on the Gaza Strip in early October. Hezbollah says it aims to support Palestinian resistance fighters battling Israeli forces in Gaza. In the latest development, Hezbollah has launched several rockets at Israeli positions in the occupied Golan Heights. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, joined us earlier from Beirut to give us the details.
a general rule that once the Israelis go beyond the scope of the rules of engagement or the limited geographic scope which Hezbollah has drawn from the beginning of the confrontation, we notice that Hezbollah directly retaliates by using Katyusha rockets, by using longer range rockets or issues that or a bigger number of rockets, if you may say, on areas that are further away from the border with Lebanon. And so we notice how there were 60 rockets that reached the settlement of Yawaf, and specifically the barracks in the Golan Heights. And here in Keilah specifically, Hezbollah mentioned in their statements that that rocket attack specifically coincided with a training session and exercise for the elite forces, the Golani elite forces of the Israelis. And they also mentioned in the statement that they had just returned from Gaza and therefore they were conducting an exercise. And so that in itself is a clear message from Hezbollah to the Israelis that Hezbollah does have the intel they need in order to know the movement of the Israelis. They are able to know which unit came back from Gaza, what exactly they were doing in that area. And so Hezbollah also seemed to mention that perhaps there could be inflicted heavy losses upon that force specifically, but also that tells the Israelis that in any future confrontation, the Israelis have always thought that they are superior when it comes to intelligence and with the fact that they do have the upper hand with their air force and so on, and their many radars and their intelligence units and their drones. But Hezbollah is also telling the Israelis that they can also deal a very heavy blow on the intelligence in that regard as well. And so therefore, this in itself is very significant, not only militarily, but also when it comes to the intelligence factor.
Calls for an end to the genocide in Gaza have once again rung out in a number of cities around the world. People in the Jordanian capital have hit the streets to voice their support for Palestinians. More than 2,000 demonstrators gathered near the Israeli embassy in Amman to condemn the regime's atrocities against Palestinians. But Jordanian police clamped down on the rally, firing tear gas at the protesters and detaining some of them. There were fresh pro-Palestinian rallies in several Iranian cities as well. Protesters in the capital, Tehran, gathered in front of the British embassy to vent their anger at the ongoing genocidal war on Gaza. The protesters chanted slogans against Israel, Britain, and the US. Several other locations in Tehran were the scenes of rallies in support of Gazans. Some other Iranian cities, including Mashhad and Tabriz, also witnessed anti-Israeli demonstrations. People in Russia have observed a national day of mourning following the deadliest terror attack in the country in two decades. Mourners laid flowers at the site in Moscow where the deadly assault happened. President Vladimir Putin has called the incident a barbaric terrorist act. On Friday, gunmen stormed Moscow's Crocus City Hall, opened fire and torched the building. At least 137 people were killed and more than 100 wounded. Marina Kortanova reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24 a National Day of Mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer a fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Meanwhile, sirens have sounded across Kiev as Russia launches fresh airstrikes on the Ukrainian capital. The strikes prompted residents to seek shelter in subway stations. The Ukrainian army said its defense systems destroyed 18 Russian missiles and 25 drones. Officials said the attack caused only minor damage. Russia also launched strikes on Ukraine's western region of Lviv. Polish armed forces say one of Russia's cruise missiles briefly violated the country's airspace. Russia has been pounding Ukraine for days. It says the strikes are in retaliation for Ukrainian drone and artillery attacks on its border areas, including the Volgograd region. Russian President Vladimir Putin has suggested the country may create a buffer zone in Kiev-controlled territories to stop the attacks. And those were the top stories. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity. Alongside Iranians in Nowruz. In the name of God, Salam everybody, welcome to the program. Today is the fifth day of Nowruz holidays. Congratulations on this ancient Iranian feast. Today we will speak about the customs of Azeri people during Nowruz. Azeri people mainly live in East Azerbaijan, West Azerbaijan, Ardabil, Zanjan, and Qazvin provinces. They are also scattered in other provinces. Stay with us, please. Azeri people are one of the genuine and ancient ethnicities of Iran. They are brave, free-spirited and honest people strongly committed to religious beliefs. Azeris call Nowruz feast as Nowruz Bayrami and Eid Bayrami. They enjoy a very rich culture with beautiful and mainly oral folklore. Nowruz is celebrated among Azeri people with specific customs. Among these customs are Takamchi, Sayachi, and Shal Salamach. Takam means male goat and Takamchi means the puppeteer of male goat. This custom has been prevalent among Azeri people for centuries. The puppeteer moves a puppet of a male goat doll while singing. The doll is usually adorned with sequins, colorful fabric, beads, and so on. Takamchi walks from street to street and door to door a few weeks before Nowruz. He makes the doll dance with a stick attached below it. He is the harbinger of spring, so a Takamchi usually sings poems in Turkish, meaning, "May your month, your year, your week, your day be blessed." In addition, different religious and social issues are also mentioned in the songs of Takamchi. These people praise the Prophet of Islam and his progeny too. Another custom that is held before Nowruz among the Azeri people is Sayachi, which means the venerator and respecter. Sayachi is a very old and beautiful custom, which is still held in some villages. Unlike Takamchi, there is no doll in Sayachi, and there is a show which is performed with poems sung to the tune of music. Sayachi goes in the middle of people and sings humorous poems to make them happy. Sayachi is also an itinerant who wears garments made from nature. He sings poems while beating sticks together to make special rhythms. He sings in praise of nature and asks God to bless people and materialize their wishes. Singers of Nowruz in Azerbaijan used to both give the news of arrival of spring and sing poems containing religious, epic, didactic and patriotic themes. Sayachi would also sing simple melodies containing praying for the audience, pleading to God for rich agriculture, and also kindness towards animals. These songs would get gifts and presents from houses. These gifts and presents were wheat, barley, pastries, and nuts, or even money. Another interesting custom among Azeri people is called Shal Salamach, meaning hanging a shawl. This custom was done on the last Wednesday of the Iranian solar calendar year. It is still performed in villages. Young boys or teenagers take a shawl and hang it from the roof of the neighbor. This is the sign of demanding Eid, that is, gift of Nowruz. The neighbor wraps some nuts, sweets, and eggs, and then the youth draws the shawl back. It should be noted that in the past, there used to be holes in roofs for ventilation of air and exit of smoke. Youths would hang shawls through those holes. Half-seen tablecloth of Azeri people is a little different from other places. As it was said earlier, Azeris call Nowruz feast and Nowruz Bayrami and Eid Bayrami, that is year feast. They spread a white tablecloth in the dining room and every guest that comes sits at the tablecloth. Then he is served kindly and warmly. Azeri people put peas, raisin, almond, walnut, colorful sweets, apple, homemade halva, etc. on the tablecloth. Azari people, like people everywhere in Iran, have the custom of gifting in Nowruz. A beautiful kind of this custom is called Bayrami Payi, which means share of Nowruz feast. This gift is given to new brides by their families. This custom dates back to several centuries ago. The families, especially mothers of new brides, prepare traditional foods such as rice, chicken, kuku, cutlet with vegetables and eggs, cooked chopped meat, stewed fish, pastries and sweets together, and take other items like fabric and put them in a large couple tray to be taken to the house of their daughter. Some families continue the custom for years after the marriage of their daughter. Well, on that note, we have to wrap up this episode. Next time, we will take you to Khorasan region in northeastern Iran, and we'll get familiar with Nowruz customs among the people over there. Goodbye.
Essence of Iranian culture. Nowruz, literally meaning the new day, is a celebration of early spring, when the sun begins to regain strength and overcome winter's cold and darkness. It's so profoundly ingrained in Iranian traditions, history, and cultural memory that Iranian identity and Nowruz have mutually buttressed each other for millennia. For ancient Iranians, it presented a struggle between good and evil on all planes, physical, moral, and spiritual, with the total victory for the good. It ushers in the loveliest season of the year with joyous festivities. There is an abundance of material attributing the festival's founding to Jamshid, the mythical king of Iran. One well-known legend is that Jamshid was drawn through the air in a chariot by Deevs, traveling in one day from Damavand to Babylon. And people made this day a feast day on account of the wonder which they had seen during it, and they amused themselves with swinging in order to imitate Jamshid. In 1079, the Seljuk Sultan Jalal al-Dawla Malik Shah established the Julian-style solar year that fixes the beginning of the calendar year, or Nowruz, at the vernal equinox, when day and night fall into balance, lasting for nearly equal lengths. Many people greet Nowruz by kindling fires and jumping over them while chanting a verse on the evening of the last Wednesday of the year, which is called Charshanbe Suri in Farsi. The festival is preceded by the scrupulous cleaning of houses and their contents.
Yeah, we have cleaned the windows, we have cleaned the whole house, all the rooms, and from the dirt and dust. And the carpets are all washed, it's all looking brand new, basically. It's a very nice feeling at home, yeah? So we are waiting, basically, for the spring start.
At the same time, people of every call and means go for the Nowruz shopping. By tradition, the Iranians buy new clothes for the new year. Buying large quantities of sweets, fruits, and dry nuts are also top of the shopping list.
Today we came here to buy some things for Nowruz Day and some gifts for our family. Nowruz Day is so interesting. We came here, people sell things here, like such as shoes, bags, handbags, and such as this fish. Today we bought some nuts and fighter fishes, something for our Damavan, because tomorrow we're going there for our holidays. Well, we came here to buy things.
The fruits, sweets, and dry nuts are placed on this sofra-e hafsin. Sofra is a dining cloth, and hafsin denotes seven items beginning with the letter sin, S, in Farsi. It is one of the components of the ritual of Nowruz observed by most Iranians. The sin items are traditionally as follows, although some of them might be variably replaced with some other sin items. 1. Sabza, that is wheat or barley and sometimes lentils grown commonly on an earthenware plate as a symbol of life and freshness. 2. Sanjed or fruit of silverberry as a symbol of love and affection. 3. Sib or apples symbolizing health and fertility. 4. Somab, a spice popular in the Middle East symbolizing happiness, patience, and perseverance. 5. Seer or garlic cloves as a symbol of protection in the face of affliction. 6. Seke or a few newly minted coins symbolizing wealth and prosperity. And 7. Samanu, a sweet paste made from germinated wheat and wheat flour symbolizing affluence and blessings. The Nowruz atmosphere picks up steam thanks to festive bands going around singing, dancing, and playing music. Haji Firuz, the most famous among the traditional folk entertainers, appears on the Iranian streets in the days preceding Nowruz. The Haji Firuz entertains passersby by singing traditional songs and dancing and playing his tambourine for a few coins. The exact moment of the turning of the year is announced in advance. In anticipation, families gather around the hafsin table, many reciting prayers intended to impart goodwill to all. Many also go to holy places, above all the holy shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad, to celebrate Nowruz. As soon as the year turns, family members get up and kiss each other and offer their greetings. Senior members give junior members their gifts, usually new banknotes. Customary congratulatory exclamations are, "May your Nowruz be happy," "May health, victory, and prosperity be with you this year, and many or a thousand years to come." And to the elders, "May God save you for us."
I born in Savatku, but it's over 18 years we are living in U.S. This is our first visit in Iran. Everything is renewing. You have hafsin everywhere. People, they are wearing new clothes. We collect lots of AD or lucky money.
Immediately afterwards or in the following morning, if the year has turned during late night, kinfolks, household servants, friends, and acquaintances visit each other, going through the same ritual. Those families who are in mourning usually visit the graves of the departed and pray, then return home. Over the past 2-3 decades, during Nowruz, some pay tribute to the fallen of the Iraqi war against Iran by going to regions once used to be front lines, where those Iranian fighters lost their lives for the sake of their country. The following days are spent visiting friends, going on picnics, and traveling to other cities and countries. Particularly favorite sites include Shiraz, Isfahan, Mashhad, and other historic monuments, as well as holy sanctuaries and shrines, or the Caspian or Persian Gulf resorts. Children especially love Nowruz. They do not need to work or go to school. They wear new clothes, receive gifts, and play various games. Many spent their time out of doors, under blossoming trees in fields and gardens, or riding horses in the vast plains of the country. Nowruz is also a favorite time for weddings. The Nowruz festival ends on the 13th day, which is called Sizdeh Bedar, or the 13th day out of doors. Every family gets out, throws the sabza away, while making a wish that with it, all mishaps may be averted. Elaborate meals are cooked and large quantities of fruits, nuts, drinks, and sweets consumed. People bid Nowruz a worthy goodbye, and then they return joyfully to their living places in the evening. Nowruz has been celebrated with considerable zeal amongst the nations of Iranian background inhabiting other lands, namely the Tajiks, Afghans, and Kurds of Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. In Tajikistan, particularly in the province of Badakhshan, Nowruz is the great festival, symbolizing friendship and renovation of all beings. In Afghanistan, Nowruz is the official holiday, and in the Balkh area, it is also called the Feast of Red Roses. Like Iranians, Afghans like to be in holy places when the year turns. The rites associated with welcoming the holiday, that is cleaning houses and buying new clothes, preparing sweet dishes and elaborate meals, and with celebrating it, that is, school holidays, visitation, exchange of gifts, partaking of sweets and fruits, are much the same as in Iran. All Kurds celebrate Nowruz with enthusiasm, even in lands where their traditions do not meet with official sanction. Everywhere, bonfires are kindled and fireworks are accompanied by music, dancing, singing, and picnicking. These are Sufi Muslims in Kosovo, celebrating the beginning of spring with a traditional dervish ritual. In fact, wherever Iranian culture has gone, Nowruz has gone with it. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, for example, Nowruz is celebrated with great fervor.
And I'm coming from Chennai, south part of India, and this is my first trip to Kashmir, and so far it's been wonderful. Kashmir is a great place to visit, and it's a lifetime experience.
Or in the United States, Iranians celebrate their fatherland's festival every year, sharing its soul, namely kindness, with the rest of the people. For years, ahead of Nowruz, many Iranians team up with charities to feed hundreds of homeless men, women, and children in the U.S.
Well, I think when our nation is so divided right now, coming together and celebrating a traditional event like this is important for everyone. It's important to the volunteers who are here to see what many of our brothers and sisters are living with. This is our 7th annual Nowruz at the Midnight Mission. We'll probably serve a couple of thousand people at this event, but at the Midnight Mission we serve just under 1 million meals a year.
Nowruz is the essence of Iranian culture. On the one hand, it is closely tied to nature. Without nature, the Iranians' biggest national festival is meaningless. On the other hand, people make up for a bulk of Nowruz festivities. The biggest gatherings of family and friends usually happen during this time. Even people at odds with each other find Nowruz the best time for reconciliation. In short, friendship with nature and people is at the heart of this lovely festival. And above all, Nowruz is about hope in the worst of times. Nowruz, the new day, will finally come, no matter how harsh or cold the winter is. Never give up. The new day will come, and we will sing and dance together in sheer happiness.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Allah wants to have a connection with you in the holy month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, an honor to be here at your service. So dear listeners, we are talking about how in this holy month of Ramadan, Allah the Almighty wants to establish a connection with you. So, we understand that the holy month of Ramadan is a banquet. It is this feast. It is this great invitation. First and foremost, this is what it is. It is this beautiful divine feast, this banquet, this invitation. Second thing, who is the host? Who is the one inviting? It is the Almighty Allah, the Creator, the Sustainer, the Compassionate, the Merciful, the All-Powerful, the All-Knowing, the All-Wise. This is the host, Allahu Akbar. What a great host indeed. And who is the one who is being invited? Well, it is you, it is me, it is all of us, it is all of humanity. Now, unfortunately, the rest of humanity who, comes under the category of non-Muslims, they aren't able to benefit from this great feast, unfortunately. And perhaps, and most surely, I guess, it's farther than perhaps, it is our responsibility to try to create awareness and help these non-Muslims, to understand the holy month of Ramadan and to understand Islam and to hopefully bring them into this fold of salvation and prosperity. So still, we are talking about the holy month of Ramadan, and we're talking about how Allah wants to establish a connection with us. Before we start to talk about that, of course, we have realized that this holy month of Ramadan is all of these great things, right? So in our example, we said that it is Allah, the host, who is inviting us, the guest, to this divine feast. And so this is where that connection is being created. Allah is calling every single one of us towards Him in this holy month of Ramadan.
Ramadan al-Mustabin Jaa bin Nur al-Mubin Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-Qanitin.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about how the Almighty Allah, the Creator, the Sustainer, the Provider, the Giver of Life and the Giver of Death, the Giver of Eternal Life, the Sustainer, the Protector, the Nurturer, the Educator, the Wise, the All-Knowing, the All-Powerful, the Mighty, the Sublime, the Glorious, the Exalted, the Almighty Allah. So we said all these different attributes in order for us to realize the greatness and the status and stature of the one who is inviting us. And who is the Almighty Allah inviting? Well, it's all of us. It's all of humanity. It is the Muslims. It is the non-Muslims. The Muslims, by the grace of Allah, benefit more from this divine feast than the non-Muslims. And we had very quickly said that, it is our duty and responsibility to invite the non-Muslims into this great feast known as Islam. And so, like we said, that this connection is already being built where Allah is inviting us, and so it is up to us to accept that invitation, and it is up to us to reciprocate that call for a connection that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Mighty, the Exalted, is putting out there. This is the holy month of Ramadan, and I just want to add one more thing, because again, time is something which flies, unfortunately, especially when you're doing good deeds. So, you know, may Allah accept from every single one of us. So what we find is that this connection that is being established in the holy month of Ramadan must be a connection that we keep, throughout the rest of the year. We must keep this connection strong. We must keep this relationship strong. It seems like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted, has taken the first step in establishing this connection by inviting us to this great divine banquet in the holy month of Ramadan. And so it just seems fair and just and honorable and noble for us to accept that invitation, accept that call for a connection, and of course continue it for the rest of our Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan.
The situation in northern Gaza is beyond desperate, says the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. Greetings, everyone, and thanks for joining us again. As always, let's kick things off with a quick review of some of the latest developments. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Tel Aviv as part of continuing negotiations towards an exchange deal and a ceasefire in the coastal enclave. Meantime, a Washington-drafted resolution vetoed by Russia and China, who said it didn't go far enough and it should have demanded a ceasefire. In the UK, an argument between the British Foreign Minister David Cameron and apartheid Israel spin doctor Ayalon Levy, the spokesman, over Tel Aviv's blocking of international aid into the strip that has caused famine conditions. Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement vows more effective retaliatory strikes in support of the Palestinian people in the Gaza Bantustan. In the West Bank, one Palestinian man is murdered and seven Israeli occupation forces injured in clashes near the Dolev illegal settlement northwest of Ramallah. In Gaza, tens of Palestinians have been killed in Israeli raids across the world's largest open-air prison in the past 24 hours alone. And since October last year, Israeli occupation forces have killed at least 32,000 Palestinian men, women, and children, and wounded more than 74,000 others. With us for this edition of the program, in the studio, British-Palestinian journalist and filmmaker Yusuf Al-Halou, and alongside him, Paris-based blogger and activist Wafa Jawad. A warm welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Wafa. More than 32,000 killed, over 74,000 wounded, as I just mentioned. Your thoughts on the scale of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza so far?
It's absolutely horrendous that this is still going on, and yet there's almost a blind eye to it all. And those who have the power are yet still silent. However, the people are not silent. The people have been galvanizing. They have been protesting. It is unbelievable that a genocide is being witnessed by millions, globally witnessed, live on their phones. And, you know, as a journalist, you know, I'm more than horrified that over 77%, 77 journalists have reportedly been killed and shot. I would call that murdered, for just doing their job, for, you know, trying to tell the actual story that what's happening in Gaza.
Absolutely, and without those journalists getting the word out, the truth out, the world wouldn't have been able to see the sheer scale and brutality of the Israeli genocidal campaign, aided and abetted, Youssef, of course, by the Americans. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is back in the region. He was in the occupied territories, Israel, talking to officials there, while ceasefire talks continue in Doha, Qatar. What would you say Blinken's visit this time around represents?
Well, his shuttle visit to the region aims to show that the U.S. is doing its part in order to convince or pressure the Israeli side, Netanyahu, to agree to a ceasefire. But as a matter of fact, the U.S. has never been an honest peace broker. I think they just want to observe the anger inside the United States, and they just want to send a message to the Palestinians to say, look, you know, it is you who to blame, that because you didn't revolt against the resistance, and it is all in the hands of Hamas. If you release the hostages, then we will have a ceasefire deal on the table.
And as you say, I think it was before we went on air, that all it takes is for the American president to tell Israel to stop, and it will stop. And we saw that Washington Post article, that expose that came out in recent weeks, saying that the American government has flooded Israel with more than 100 rounds of weaponry that included tank shells and other weaponry to be dropped on Palestinians. And at the same time, they're speaking of building a pier, using the rubble from the Gaza Strip to get aid in. How do you those square the first one with the second?
It's contradiction. You know, you cannot just send bomb to Israel and at the same time you are sending aid and dropping them from the air. This is a humiliation to the Palestinian side. Israel is the most recipient of American aid in terms of military financial support.
And diplomatic.
And diplomatic support and backing. Biden says if there's no Israel, he would create Israel. And he's a loyal Zionist. So it seems to me that the U.S. is buying time, pressuring the Palestinian side and aligning themselves with Israel's narrative and Israel's story. And when they are talking about building a port, many are fearful that this port could be a signal to encourage Palestinians to leave to the outside world. This is what Israel wants, an ethnic cleansing to their territories of 2.5 million people.
Exactly. And Wafa, pretty much the same question to you. Of all the resolutions at the UN Security Council so far to call for an immediate ceasefire, we have seen the U.S. veto every single one of them, followed by abstentions by the U.K. government. What do you make of the roles that these two countries have been playing as far as this genocidal campaign is concerned?
It's absolutely atrocious that they're the ones who are funding this genocide. They're the ones who are flaming the flames higher. Yet they seem not to take any accountability or responsibility. The same is happening through, you know, obviously France, where I'm residing at the moment. Although the government has slowly tried to back down and slowly, you know, distance itself from it all, yet it's still complicit. It's absolutely atrocious that they're the ones who are backing and they're the ones who are, you know, doing this genocide, are almost washing their hands of it all. But the people are watching, the people are listening, yeah. Especially the ones that I see here in the streets of Paris, where myself and my sons have been demonstrating. There are several prominent members of parliament, of the French parliament, and also lawyers, advocates. You know, we are galvanizing the people here and, you know, hoping that they've got, you know, this kind of pressure may allow the government to you know, do something. I know in the UK this has been happening quite a lot, to the extent that it has threatened the government and it has threatened how they perceive it. And now they want to demonize freedom of expression. They want to demonize activists brand them with a brush of terrorism.
Exactly. And none of that, of course, has so far deterred pro-Palestine protesters from taking to the streets. As you say, of course, public pressure is working. That perhaps explains partly why countries across the European bloc have changed their tone. The 27 European Union countries have overcome, apparently, their differences and finally agreed to